Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that. And find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps, because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's ANGI.com.
Greetings, humans. You have entered the command zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Hey guys and gals, welcome back to another episode of The Command Zone. We are here with your host, myself, Jimmy Wong.
How's it? It's Josh Lee Kwai.
Yeah.
And Alex Kessler.
Special guest, returning.
Woo!
You're our first returning guest.
Really? Ooh. I'm the first number two?
You're the first number two. I don't know if that's a...
You're number two only to yourself.
Who does number two work for?
Who does number two work for?
Alex, thank you again for coming. If you guys don't remember, Alex is a part of Webisodes Network, the company that's responsible for top decking.
Woo!
Yeah, one of the very few shows out there about Magic the Gathering.
And the best show.
It's like Scrubs and Clerks meets Magic the Gathering players.
That's a good description. I like that.
You've been working on that logline?
Oh, yeah, for like a good 3 years.
Yeah, VGHS definitely takes a lot of inspiration from Scrubs, too. So I like that our worlds coexist.
All right, pseudo not reality reality, where have the ability to like look up into the distance and then imagination takes over.
Yeah.
Imagination.
I have that ability in real life. Saw. I don't know what you guys are talking about. Yeah.
That's pretty amazing.
You might have JD from Scrub disease.
I just want to be the janitor.
Is that the official? Is that the Latin name for it?
Yeah. Apparently, actually, in the first season, he was supposed to be schizophrenic, and the janitor doesn't talk to a single other person in the entire first season of Scrubs because he was supposed to be a figment of JD's imagination, and he was going to go to the hospital, and that was going to be the end if it got canceled after one season. And then it didn't.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah. That's also a really dark ending.
Oh, yeah. Well, the first season's really dark. People die all the time in that show.
It's a hospital. Yeah, it's true.
So Alex is also here because you have started a new podcast. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, we decided that, this is the Command Cast and it's all about casual fun play, and to expand it into the competitive zone of Magic the Gathering, we started Masters of Modern. Me and Glenn Jones are your hosts on that. We actually released our first episode last week. So we actually have an episode coming out tomorrow as well, starring Jimmy Wong as our guest host.
Yeah, talking about my first experience
at the Friday Night Magic type event. We're going to do this whole thing where we're going to take Jimmy through the entire competitive ringer, starting with FNM and eventually getting to the Pro Tour.
The Pro Tour?
Yeah.
You guys didn't know, but Jimmy is going pro.
Yeah, it's a self-proclaimed goal that has really become...
It's really my fault.
It's become a reality in the past 3 days, more so than it ever has.
Did you have Moto 3 days ago?
Yeah, actually, I did.
Okay, well, now Jimmy is now on the Magic Gathering Online and won his first 8-4 draft within the last 24 hours.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. I guess I'm going pro. If I do make it to the Pro Tour, I'm going to wear a t-shirt with all of your faces on it and hopefully get on with the coverage. I think that'd be pretty fun.
So if you haven't checked out the Masters of Modern podcast, you can find it on rocketjump.com, the same place you can find this podcast. So you've probably already seen it, I guess, if you're listening to this right now.
We're creating a podcast Magic the Gathering family.
Yeah.
Filled with hugs and swamps.
And quality audio
hugs
recordings.
Hugs and swamps.
Hugs and swamps.
You can't see, but we're all hugging each other right now.
Right.
No, we're not.
Tapping a lot of black mana.
No, we're not. We're not doing any of that.
Tapping all that black mana.
We're sitting a safe distance apart. So our main topic today, we're going to talk about cutting. Cutting cards from your deck, what to cut, how to cut, why you cut. Well, that's a pretty obvious reason as to why you cut. But sort of the whole broad range of cutting and how it affects your play style and how it affects specifically your commander, how it applies to other formats of Magic the Gathering. And we're going to finish it off with a spotlight on one of Alex's decks, a wonderful little gnome. What is he?
He's a Kithkin.
Oh, he's a Kithkin. Close enough.
A Kithkin advisor, I think is exactly
his
what he
name is. His name is Gaddick Teague. And so that will be...
He is a douchebag.
He's a douchebag.
Kithkin advisor. Okay. Kithkin advisor.
I'm actually really excited to talk about this deck because we haven't done a really mean deck yet.
Some of the like super competitive.
Yeah, this is like, a mean deck. I like it. Yeah. It's gonna be gonna be fun to talk about. Nope. So this is a more competitive deck. So you more spiky people out there, you more spiky EDH players out there, I'm sure you exist.
Yeah, no,
this is for you. This is for you. Well, Kessler, I see one right in front of me. That's you.
Yeah,
on this podcast.
You're
podcast
the pro, today. Kessler's the spike.
On the command cast, I'm a spike. On Modern, Masters of Modern, I'm a Johnny. It's very confusing. I have multiple personalities.
I would love to be on the pro tour and be a Timmy. You think a Timmy could make it all the way?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He just really likes playing.
They're called grinders.
Like, naturally good at it. Like, just Rain Man status Magic player, but just likes playing Magic.
Yeah, someday I'll get there.
Definitely 8-4. Yeah.
So, Alex, we brought you in today to talk about cutting cards because...
And like deck trimming
scissors,
in general,
right?
Yeah.
Like just confetti?
Yeah.
Like Blacker Lotus?
Blacker Lotus, yeah, so you can spray it all over the table.
Chaos confetti.
Chaos. I think chaos,
those, yeah, those are the two actual card-cutting cards.
Because you are definitely amongst our player group of friends, I think you have the most experience in all the formats. You know, you just have the widest range of knowledge about Magic and... We think it's very valuable when talking about a subject like this.
Thank you.
So, yeah, do you want to explain really quick, like, what deck trimming or cutting is?
So, and we're going to break down one of these pretty definitively. There's kind of two ways of kind of going about building a deck. Mm-hmm. And one of them is figuring out exactly what you want to do and then filling slots among your curve. And we're going to kind of go into that whole mm-hmm. process. And then the other one, which I think is the most common one, is... Just picking a general and throwing all the cards you think that might be good in a pile and then slowly whittling it down until you finally have that 99 card limit that you're supposed to fall into with the whole commander.
Yeah, I think that's a way a lot of people build the deck. Right. You know, the other thing I think that this discussion is going to cover is like when you discover a new card, like somebody plays it against you or you see it somewhere or it's from the newest set and you're like, that fits perfectly into my Gaddick T deck. Yeah. Right. And then you're in the position of like, oh, but my deck has all cards I like right now, so which one do I replace this new card with?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Or which one do I replace the old card with the new card? I don't know how I worded that weird.
The sentence got there. We understood.
I think people got it. Okay. So I want to talk about how deck trimming or cutting cards is maybe a little bit different in EDH than it is in other formats. I think one of the ways is that in like a regular constructed format, you know, a lot of times you've got four ofs. Mm-hmm. And so you're just replacing, you know, four of whatever with an entirely different card. And it's because it's singleton. In a lot of ways, like when I started building decks in EDH, I thought, oh, this is going to be really easy because I can only have one of everything. I'll always have a couple cards at the end and I'm just like, whatever, I'll throw that in because I couldn't find 65 cards that go with this. But it's actually the opposite. It's like there's always 300 cards I want to put in the deck and it's really hard to get down to 65.
Right. And when it comes to like... 60 card decks in general or 75 card decks, including the sideboard, it's a lot more of kind of tuning your deck for the metagame and your choices are much more about consistency and what you're trying to do and a game plan. Well, because of the singleton part of EDH, it's much more about crafting a deck that's consistent over being so different every single time you play it.
Right.
So
it's easier to achieve consistency in another constructed format, but it's difficult in EDH, so you're actually, in a weird way, like you have to worry about it more.
Right. Or, I mean, there's I guess, two ways to do it. One is worry about it, or the other one is make a deck that just plays differently every time you put your hands on it. And like
that can be okay.
That can be okay.
Yeah.
It would be a different world if we could have four Solar Rings in every single commander deck, because you would have a much more consistent... Because
then you would have four Solar Rings in every single commander
right.
deck.
No.
I mean, at least you would curve out, always.
I don't think there's a single format where you can play more than one Solar Ring. in Magic at all.
Because it's been restricted and banned. Right. When I first started playing, you could actually play as many as you wanted.
Right.
As many?
Yeah. They didn't have the four of rule yet either. Wow. And it hadn't been restricted.
20 soul rings.
I forget who did it. And nobody had someone's going to look it up and maybe we can find it and put a link. But there was actually someone went through what if you could play unlimited cards and like
what
doesn't matter.
The best deck be?
And there is a deck that consistently wins on turn zero no matter what and can't lose.
Turn zero?
Yeah.
How's that even happen?
Well, because there's the lands that come into play.
You can play as many Black Lotuses as you want.
That's true.
But like Black Lotus and lands that come into play on your opponents, like if they're in your opening hand, a gemstone, something, cavern. And it just goes off and you win. Enough Anshul Recalls, Force of Wills, Black Lotuses, and a card that wins is enough to kill any opponent no matter what.
Those old cards are powerful. Fortunately, back when we started playing, nobody owned that many of any of those cards. So
no one owns that many of those many cards
true,
now.
Well, true.
How many people know that more? Like, at most, two Black Lotus.
Something I wanted to touch on, because a couple episodes ago, we talked with Marshall Sutcliffe about card evaluation. And card evaluation is related to cutting and trimming your deck, but it's not the same thing. You know, card evaluation is sort of more based off of what the value of a card is in a vacuum a little bit.
Right.
Yeah, so it's like looking at the mana cost versus its power and toughness versus whatever else, you know, the card does. You know, it's sort of the value of the card advantage-wise, things like that, which you take into consideration when you're doing cutting and trimming. You know, an example I came up with is like Mull Drifter.
Yeah. Love Mull Drifter. Mull Drifter is a 4 and a blue for a 2/2 flyer that when it enters the battlefield, you draw two cards. And then you can also evoke it, which is an ability that lets you cast it for a reduced casting cost. So you cast it for 2 and a blue. And when it comes into play, you have to immediately sacrifice it.
Right.
So it kind of acts as a pseudo divination, which is a 1 blue, 2 colorless, draw two cards.
Right. So awesome card. You know, most blue decks are going to want to run it. So my example is like, if you could build a deck with just 62 Mull Drifters and 38 land in EDH, you know, I don't necessarily think that would be the best thing to do. Even though that card is very powerful on its own and very, very good, that deck isn't going to be, you know, necessarily the deck that you would want to play.
Yeah.
I would immediately play with 62 Mull Drifters and 38 blue lands.
You'd play it once, though.
I'd play it every day.
You'd play it once, though.
You draw so many cards, and Mull Drifter is good always.
I think that deck loses to a lot of EDH decks, though.
Yeah.
How? You're just card
every
advantage.
Card you drew.
All of the card advantage. They bought your board, you have a bunch of Mull Drifters in your hand.
For one. Yeah. For one, you got no ramp.
Yeah.
So you're not doing anything until turn five.
No, turn three, you can draw two cards.
Oh, turn three, you can draw two cards. You might as well draw two more Mull Drifters.
Yeah.
Yeah, you have no ability to interact with anything that your opponent's doing. Like, it's an awesome card, but you wouldn't want 62 of them. So, you know, the point there is that there's diminishing returns with certain cards. So this is what cutting and trimming really comes down to, because card evaluation tells me Mull Drifter, awesome card. But when I get down to building my deck, I don't want I don't want my deck full of that effect. I need a variety of effects.
Right. And we've talked about the variety of effects that you do want to put in your decks, essentially. And you know, they range from having your removal package to having your much needed mana rocks. Kessler, you've talked about every deck really needing a Sensei's Divining Top. It's just sort of one of the crucial cards that most commander decks should run if you can afford it.
There are five artifacts that every deck should probably run in. Sensei's Divining Top, Soul Ring. These are cards that, like, because of their availability, some of them aren't available to be in every deck, but there is not a deck that would not be better with Sensei's Divining Top in it.
Right. And there's also a lot of cards that you think you should run in most decks, but doesn't necessarily actually make the cut in a lot of decks. For instance, if you're running a monocolor general, having a Gilded Lotus may not be your best bet for a mana rock.
Yeah, that's a really good point. There's another card. Card evaluation tells me it's very good. But there are decks where maybe it's not.
Well, plus you could be playing a Mull Drifter instead, and that card's better.
Not if you're mono red.
Yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, this moves to the next point that I wanted to cover, which is what I'm calling ratio. So, you know, the first thing that falls under this is mana curve. Mana curve gets thrown on a lot. I don't know, Alex, do you want to tackle what mana curve is exactly?
Mana curve is a concept where you want to make it so you play a card every turn of the game. And you want to play the best possible card you can. So on turn one, you want to play a one drop. On turn two, you want to play a two drop, because mana efficiency means that you're using your mana to the best of its ability and playing the most powerful spells. Because generally, a three drop is more powerful than a two drop is more powerful than a one drop. Not always, because arguably
it goes around
Sol Ring's better than every other card ever printed, and it's a one drop. Yeah. But generally, you know, you want to be playing your deck needs to be built in a way that allows you to play spells consistently in the beginning, but also doesn't mean you get beat out by more powerful cards in the end before you can beat your opponents.
Mm-hmm. I think this comes from a concept that's fairly popular, which is that the player that uses the most mana in a game generally wins that game, which is really from non-EDH formats.
True.
But
true.
But that's a philosophy that...
Which is why the Muldrifter deck is going to be way better.
So that's a philosophy that comes from that. Doesn't necessarily work in EDH. I also think mana curve in EDH is different. You don't necessarily ever want to play a one-drop every game. I mean, you want Sol Ring, you want certain ones.
Right.
But you don't want to put... You know, the idea behind mana curve is that you have enough cards in your deck that fill each spot on the curve that you can reliably draw those cards when you need them and play them on time, right?
One of the important things about mana curve is you don't want, like, theoretically, you could put every powerful 7-drop ever created into your deck and have 65 7-drops, but then you're not doing anything until turn 7 if you draw the right lands and enough lands in time.
Right.
And then you're only playing one card a turn where, like, if you have a bunch of 4-drops, once you get to turn 8, you may be able to play two of them or one of them and consistently up to that point. But one of the reasons Muldrifter is powerful and the reason you include it is because of the evoke ability. It allows you to be, if you draw it late game, I get a 2-2 flyer, which is decent, plus draw two cards. Or early game, if I'm like, well, I need to get those extra lands, you can play it for 3 mana. And so adding that versatility is what's really strong about the card.
Right. Yeah, and anything, that's why Bestow was such a good mechanic in Theros, is because it's anything that can fill two spots on your curve is extremely powerful, because, you know, if you can get additional utility if you draw it late, then it's just a really strong card, but it still has some use early. So that's what mana curve is about. So that's something when you're cutting, when you're trimming your deck, is to look at the curve of the cards you've got. And if you have a whole lot of 7-8 high casting cost stuff, you know, depending on your deck, you may not want to put in another high casting cost thing. Or if you do, you don't want to be taking out a 2-drop and putting in a 7-drop.
Just going to say, the best way to figure out when you don't want a card in your deck is when you play a game and the card's sitting in your hand and you're going, I don't want to play this card right now. This is not going to do anything for me. Situationally, I don't even see when this is going to do anything for me. Like, that's an easy cut. But what you're talking about, taking a card out to put another one in, I think is really easy when you have a deck built and it's ready to go and you're like, well, you know, this wasn't performing, so I'm going to take this out and put this other sweet card in instead, when actually doing that may negatively affect your deck, because you may do something, like you said, where you take out a mana ramper and replace it with a high CMC cost guy. So, like, you always have to be weighing sort of your additions into any deck as opposed to what you're taking out and seeing what you're affecting. So specifically, like, we were talking about, like, how much card draw do you need in every single deck? You know, every deck, I'd say, unless you just have no options, needs some form of card draw in Commander, because you have a 99-card deck. You need to get through those cards. So, like, Kessler, what do you usually run in terms of, like, decks? Or do you say, like, 10% of your cards are card draw, 5%?
It depends on the colors. I mean, the more heavier white a deck is, the more card advantage is got in by effects like board wipes, where it's not necessarily that you're drawing more cards, is that you play less cards and then kill all of your opponent's cards that they drew into and played. So, you know, each color kind of affects this differently. And classically, until very recently, it's one of the reasons red has been one of the worst colors in EDH, because it has the worst board wipes, which is, and the worst, like, red's ability is to kill your opponent before they out card advantage you in constructed or in 60 card decks. But in EDH, that isn't a very effective strategy. Mm-hmm. And so classically, it had a lot of trouble really competing with other decks that without using unfun strategies. So, like, you know, one of its card advantage abilities is destroying all lands like Jockalops, did I say that right?
No, I think that
Jockalhops,
whatever it is.
I'm not sure the J is. I don't know. Jeez, it's like
Jockalhops.
Yeah, I think
Jockalhops. Jockalhops. Jockalhops.
Old
card. Who knows? The Dutch, maybe.
Destroys everything. The cards that destroys everything.
So, like, those are the way it does, but no one likes those cards. So, like, red either has this weird, I'm either unfun or I'm not good enough effect. Until recently, I think they've recently started making ways like
Kiki Jiki
M15 had the card that's basically Minecraft that Notch created.
That's
like aggressive mining, where you're stacking lands for card advantage. So, like, they're adding interesting things to red, but it kind of depends on each color.
Yeah, you know, this brings us to something that, like, my philosophy is to look at things like card advantage. Look at what I call categories. So there's, like, ramp, you know, there's card advantage, there's, or sorry, card draw, there's tutors, there's these categories that most decks want. And I sort of look at that like mana curve. So I want a certain percent of my deck to be ramp, and I want a certain percentage of it to be card draw. You know, and so this makes it easier when I'm going later to replace cards or I'm trimming the deck down. It's like, well, I have 20 card draw cards. Now, if my deck is not built around card draw, if it's trying to do something else, then I don't need, you know, literally 20% of my deck to be card draw. So that tells me, okay, that's an area where I can trim. Or my deck is, you know, 15% ramp and it's not looking to play like huge spells later. It's just like I pulled out all my good ramp cards and put them into a pile. So that's an area where I can trim. Like it makes it a little bit easier for me to find those areas to start trimming down.
Right. And I guess the one other thing about card advantage specifically in Commander is that it's a completely different beast than in other forms of Magic because it's so much more about my one card has to compete with three other players at the table.
Right.
Versus in 60 card decks, like Divination is theoretically always powerful because, or not always powerful, but relatively more powerful because I draw
two cards
and they don't. But in Commander, I drew two cards, but then every other player is doing a bunch of stuff on their turn and I did nothing on my turn. So you have to really kind of think about what you're doing to further your game plan along with gaining this card advantage that you're going for. Or am I drawing so many cards that it's just ridiculous to a level that I'm now just in such a higher advantage with like cards with like Consecrated Sphinx, which is a 4/6 that every time another player draws a card, you draw two cards. So like it automatically outdraws every other person playing and draws too many cards.
Yeah, you always have too many cards when you've got that card in play. But I think the important thing here is just that idea of like keeping your ratios, finding that real sweet spot for your deck. You know, like you said, you played Gaddock Teeg a lot. So that's what you were saying when you played it a lot is like, oh, if I'm going to take out this, you probably want to replace it with a sort of similar effect, right? Like if you're going to take out a 2-drop, you probably want to put something that's around that cost or filling a role but just doing it better.
Right.
Yeah. You know, you're not going to, unless you said, oh, well, my deck's not drawing enough cards and I always find myself with only a card or two in my hands and I'm top decking, then you know you need to add card draw to that deck.
Right.
You know, but I always have 7 cards, but I keep dying to board wipes. Okay, now I need to change my deck, maybe take out some of my card draw and put in, you know, things that are sort of covering bases that I don't have covered.
Right. And I think that's really the interesting moment in cutting cards is the moment where it's not such a 2-for-1. It's not like, oh, I have this card that ramps me, but this card was just printed that's better at ramping me.
Mm-hmm.
It's the moment where, oh, I want to add this new effect to my deck. My deck is weak to this ability, and I want to be able to do this thing. But no other card on my deck seems like a easy cut for this situation.
Right.
And especially if you've been testing a deck for a while, you're emotionally attached to every card that's in that 63 cards that are in there. So you're like, oh, do I want to cut this favorite card or do I want to cut this favorite card?
This one I just bought for this so much. Yeah.
Like, you know, this card's not good all the time, but there was that one time where I like wrecked everyone because they let me get away with it. And it's like every card has a story, but you kind of need to make that emotional decision to like, no, it's time to maybe this doesn't belong in the deck. This isn't as good as you expected it to be.
I think that's also a strength of having several commander decks if you have the budget and time
to make a point.
Couple. Because, I mean, I feel like Commander is a format that rewards the Timmy within all of us on many different levels. So you're going to have a deck that is filled with more emotionally, just like you're tied to those cards a little more because you're like, it can get this thing out. I can use my Gigantomancer to make all these 1/1 snakes into 7/7s or whatever. You know, like every deck that you make has the possibility for stuff like that. And it's just up to you to decide whether or not you want your deck to be ultra competitive and like trimmed down with all the excess fat off of there, or if you want it to be more of just a fun group hug or just fun deck in general.
Well, I mean, given, let's just say that you're trying to win a little bit more. You know, I think the reason we have these discussions is to sort of like come up with more optimal ways to do things, you know, give people ways to think about things that maybe they're not thinking about, you know, and I think the ratio idea, the mana curve idea, you know, is good to keep in mind. Yeah, you can, you know, you can have fun. You can do the 70% thing, Alex, you've talked about before, which is this idea of like you build your deck and then you take out 30% of the good stuff and put in 30% more dirty stuff. And you know, it's actually can help you win a little bit more in multiplayer because you're not as scary.
Right.
Yeah. But, you know, you're still trying to win, right? So, so, you know, a way to think about this, you know, sort of the ratio thing, I thought of token decks as an example. You know, I have a couple token decks. I really like them. And what I found with token decks, you know, through playing them a lot is that, you know, you run into this issue when you're building a token deck. It's like, I have token cards and then I have mass pump or Anthem effects, right? So I either play, make a bunch of little dudes, you know, that's one choice of a card, and another card is make all my little dudes huge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and what you run into is, like, where's the sweet spot? Like, do I want 50 cards that make dudes and only 10 cards that pump them, or do I want 50 cards that pump them and only 10 things that make dudes? And, you know, after you play for a while, you learn with token decks, you want 50 cards that make tokens and only 10 cards that make them big, because you can win with just tokens. You can't win with just pump spells.
A token is objectively powerful. A pump spell is only subjectively powerful.
Right.
Well
depending
said.
On your board set. Very well said. Also, one thing I realized is that if you do want to make your dreams come true, so let's say you are a Timmy and your dream is to make 50/50/50s because of you want tokens out, and then you're going to drop Crater of Behemoth.
Right.
Right, which is a card that gives all your creatures +X/+X, which is equal to the number of creatures you have on board. So it's let's say you that's your single goal of the deck is just to get there. Well, in that case, like you're going to want to cut the cards that inhibit you from getting your inner Timmy on, which means you need to make sure that you A, get the tokens out, and B, hit the mana needed to get Crater of Behemoth out, preferably earlier rather than later. Right.
I mean, that deck to a competitive level would be token generators that token generate on a massive scale, and then cards that let you cheat and search out Crater of Behemoth from your deck in some consistent manner.
Yeah, and cheat them out, yeah.
Yeah, so, that actually, that points out why tutors are so powerful, and why, like, every EDH deck needs as many tutors in its color as it can get, because it gives you the versatility. Like now that card in the token example from before, what's a tutor? It's not a token maker. It's not a pump spell. It's both.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, and in a format like EDH where it's so variance heavy and, you know, every game can play completely differently, the tutors allow you to offer some type of consistency above just having
They fill in a mana curve. Right. It's similar to what we were talking about, mana curve either. Earlier, which is like you can use it on turn two, you can also use it on turn 10.
Yeah.
And not to mention, like, the only consistency in EDH is your commander. That's how it's built, really.
Right.
And tutors allow you to A, make it a little bit more consistent, but B, also kind of protect your commander because commanders are the only consistency level. A lot of decks are built to have that be their, like, the thing they're leaning on.
Right.
But then that makes it so other decks are built to get rid of the generals in a permanent manner by tucking it or whatever. And tutors allow you to find that general back, so you're not left, like, if my game plan is only to get my general out and play and do something with it, I need a way to get my general back if it goes away forever.
Right. Well, speaking of general, the last point I wanted to make in this sort of ratio discussion is, like, the general will a lot of times determine, like, another category for you. So, last episode we talked about Rafik, and Rafik has a big exalted theme, and so, you know, that's another thing, another category that's going to be you know, only in the Rafik deck or only in decks like Rafik is like cards that give me exalted, and you're gonna have to find the sweet spot for how many of those you want in the deck, and then, you know, that gives you, you know, you don't want 50 necessarily cards that give you exalted in that deck. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, just as an example.
Right, right.
Do you want 50 cards that give you exalted
Definitely
in that deck?
Definitely not.
I think with Rafik, the main thing you want to focus on is more along the lines of, I'm attacking with one creature.
Yeah.
How do I make the fact that I'm attacking with one creature very good?
Yeah. And it's a combination of exalted.
Right. Exalted
pump,
equipment, spells.
Yeah, so it's a
tremendous. So it's really like, the category is really like Voltron-y stuff.
Yeah.
Right? So that you only want X amount of that stuff, and that's a category for you. And you still want a category that says card draw, and you still want a category that says that says ramp.
Right.
You know, and so your general, your commander is going to determine, you know, maybe one or two of those other categories that, you know, you're going to use to separate your cards so you can start trimming it down.
Right. Yeah, and not to mention versatility is often one of the most important things in the commander deck, because you don't know who you're going to go up against. You don't know what's going to come at you. So if you have multiple ways of addressing your main needs, which is, to say in the Voltron deck, other ways to make sure your commander can, or your just single creature attacking can do that damage, the better time you're going to have in general, because it just means that you're able to make what you're trying to do come true more often.
Right, and with versatility, I mean, it also lets this card cutting concept be a little bit easier, because so, for instance, in Teague, which we'll talk about later, I have a card called Yavimai Elder, which is a 2/1 for 3 that when it leaves the battlefield, it lets you search for two basic lands and put them in your hand, and it also, when you can pay 2 mana to sacrifice it to draw a card. And the reason it's really versatile, and the reason I really like it, is because if I need a 2/1 creature for, you know, putting an equipment on it or blocking or just being defensive, it's there. Mm-hmm. If I need to mana fix or get lands to get to my bigger spells, I can use it. If I need to just kind of cycle through my deck to get more powerful cards or get a creature card in my graveyard, it's there.
It's almost like a dual land in a way, because when you're divvying up your land and you're looking at how many lands do I have that produce red mana and how many do I have that produce black, well, Badlands produces both, and it fits into both categories. So it actually covers both of those bases. So
we're, right.
So like it's we talked about like Rogue's Passage, which is goes in your Voltrani Rafik deck, but it also gives you mana. So it can fill the slot of a land in your deck and also cover a slot for
evasion.
Yeah, for an evasion. Yeah.
Right.
So that's why those cards are the best cards. Right. Because and that will help you when you're trimming down your deck also, because it's like, oh well, I can put Rogue's Passage in, I can take it out an unblockable effect and a land, and now I can put another card in, you know,
yeah,
that covers another base that maybe I need to cover, right. And I still have the same amount of effects. My ratio is what I want it to be.
Yeah.
So
the ratio, I get ratio category that we're in. Something about commanders and filling slots on your mana curve specifically is sometimes your commander actually can give you curve considerations. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, in Geist, who is my favorite deck, who maybe in the future we will get to check out. It's the only deck I have that is 100%.
He's inviting
foil.
Himself back on the podcast, everybody.
I will be back.
Otherwise, there'll be a Masters of Modern podcast about EDH. Yeah.
That's better. EDH, this is Geist. But Geist is Entrapped, if you guys don't know, the important fact is it's a very aggressive hexproof creature for 3 mana that is a 2/2 that creates an angel that swings for 4 and does a lot of damage.
And but the important, goes away every time.
It goes away at the end of turn. But the important thing is that it's a hexproof 3 drop for hexproof 3 drop creature is my general. Mm-hmm. So the reason that's important is A, it's a very hard to get rid of creature. So I can consistently know that on turn 3 and in general I'll have a pretty decently
It's safe to cast it.
Right. It's a card that is easy to cast. Not even safe to cast it. It's just it will stick around. So I don't
it's
need...
It's safe. With a lot of low casting cost generals, you still don't end up casting them on the turn you could because you're like, well, if I don't have some way to protect it, I can't put it out yet.
Right. The other reason it's important is because he's so consistently going to stay in play, I don't play a lot of other creatures in the deck. I don't need to. I have my creature that I need to strap up giant swords to and make consistently more powerful. So it allows me to play spells and artifacts and mana rocks and other things that normally would be put into play for, like, I need a creature that's going to attack someone. I don't need that. My general is
you have that.
Yeah, I have that. And
so that affects your ratio.
Around. Right, exactly. So it kind of affects my ratio. It also means that on turn 3, I always have something to play that I'm going to play on turn 3.
So you don't need as many 3-drops.
So 3-drops are not nearly as important as 2-drops and 4-drops because Geist is going to be the card that's coming down.
Really good stuff. Really good stuff. That's really interesting.
So always, evaluate your commander against what your deck specifically needs. And if your deck starts to have stuff that starts to go contrary to what your commander is, or essentially just is either proving the point too much, you know, sort of like having 50 exalted cards in a Rafik deck when there would be better slots for other things. That's, I'd say, the best first point to starting off on when you're looking through your deck and you need to figure out what to take out.
I really like that idea, though, of the curve consideration being affected by the card you know will basically always be available to you.
Yeah. Right.
So it's like not like a normal deck where I need, you know, if you're building a standard deck, and you want it to be pretty aggressive, you might want 12 2-drops. Because why do you put 12 2-drops in? It's not because you want to draw 12. It's because you want to make sure that you have one on turn 2.
You want to always consistently play something on turn 2. Because if you're not, then your opponent will be aggressively doing it and will kill you because you will not have enough spells to play.
Exactly. But in Commander, you know you're going to have your Commander. So that slot, you don't need a lot of redundancy.
Right.
Because you know you're going to
always have a 2-drop. So, and you know, even a 2-drop and a 4-drop and a 6-drop, because if it dies, I know I have the consistent playability there. So it's important to be able to know that this is what I have available to me. So it's not as important that I fill my slot out on the 2-drop.
That's a really good point. I really like that. So I guess now that we know like ratios are important and we want to pay attention to the ratio of card draw and card ramp and whatever mechanic we're going after and all this stuff, you know, how do we go about determining what those ratios should be?
Math. Actually, it's very simple if you think about it. 99 cards, 35 to 37 of those are going to be lands. You're drawing 7 in your opening hand and 1 on your first turn. Very basic math as to where to start. It's just like, when do I need these cards? What's the chance of me drawing them?
Yeah, in Magic in general, you want to aim for 40% land, 60% not land. Mm-hmm. Gas spells. Mm-hmm.
That can be affected by what kind of ramp you've got and how much that ramp costs.
Yeah. That is a loose... I mean, like, for instance, in draft, normally you want 23-17, but if your deck is hyper-aggressive and low-costed, you can go cut that 16 down so that you're more consistently playing creatures.
Right.
Or if you're all big spells and card draw, you can play one more land because, you know, you can draw into gas and it's more important that you draw into... You know, be able to play your spells because if you can't, then you're not going to be able to beat your opponent. In EDH, something always taken into consideration, and I often actually count Sol Ring, which we've talked about should be in every deck,
as a single
land. Yeah. Because
it should literally be in every EDH deck.
Right. Yeah. And it comes in every
commander deck. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And they've made it so prolific that in all the commander pre-constructed decks that it's not hard to get your hands on. Oh, it's still not like, still five, for how much they've reprinted it, it's still expensive because every commander player needs it.
But yeah, it still has tons of value regardless.
And it's
possibly
the best card ever printed.
I would be careful though. Like, Sol Ring is, I think, one of the few cards that you can substitute straight up for a land.
Yes.
I think a lot of people get, especially newer players, get sort of over hyped, you know, and think like, okay, I've got these three rocks, that counts for two lands, and you start cutting out lands because they want to put in a sweet card instead. Because to them, it's like, you know, this is an awesome three drop. I don't need that extra land. Like, when am I going to see it or whatever? And it's like, you need to make sure that you don't do that.
Right.
Because your consistency will be hurt. And that's the last thing you want to do, is not be able to play your spells.
It's really important. It's a really good point. A lot of new players like to skimp on the lands because it's not an exciting part of the game. Like, when you're building your deck, like, what do you want? You want spells. That's what you're excited to play. You're not excited to put a land down and tap it. But at the same time, I think the more experience you get, the more lands you want to put in your deck.
Right.
Like,
in
general, like, you're just like, I just want to be able to play my stuff because I've built my deck in a way that my stuff works together. So the most important thing is just actually being able to cast it.
Right. And that's why I love lands that do stuff.
Right.
Lands that do anything other than tap for mana are like my favorite. But lands that do stuff is just so sweet.
And historically, incredibly powerful.
Yeah,
in Magic for that reason.
I mean, to be totally honest, the artifact lands that arguably do nothing but be an artifact, or banned in Standard.
Yeah, they're awesome.
Right.
Yeah, and I'd say almost all of the lands, I mean, if you look at most Modern and Standard decks, they all have, I mean, I'd say a lot of the most competitive decks have a land in there that is a huge part of their win condition.
I mean, Mutavault's been...
Mutavault, Celestial Colonnade.
Yeah, Mutavault heavily warped Standard around itself.
So some questions I like to ask to help me sort of start to determine what ratios, you know, I want in my deck. One is like, what is my deck ultimately trying to do? You know, so we're going to talk about Teague later. He's kind of trying to stop everybody else from doing what they want to do.
Lock down the game plan.
Rafiq is trying to attack with one big threat. Marchesa, we've talked about in the past, she's trying to reoccur all your other creatures constantly. You know,
Helva's trying to get off a big spell.
Helva's trying to get off a big spell. You know, you should be able, I think you should be able to, it's like the log line of a movie. You should be able to sum it up in one sentence what your deck's trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, in most cases. And so that will help you determine your ratio, because that category, like Helva, Jaleva, for those that didn't listen to the episode, Jaleva wants to cast big instants and sorceries. So big instants and sorceries is a big category in that deck. And ratio-wise, I want it to be a large percentage of my deck. Because if I'm trying to do that, and only 10% of my deck is that, then it's not going to work.
Yeah. Right. And the thing you have to take in consideration there is, with a deck like that where it's so specifically minded and I need big spells, those big spells are going to cut into other categories you normally have. So you're not going to have as many card draw engine, maybe, or you're not going to have as many like
ramp spells
or the normal
card draws
or your Hail Marys,
deck fixing, you know.
Right. So the deck is much more based on having this huge game A plan, which makes it a little bit easier and a little bit harder, because you can't do your normal, I'm going to throw these cards that I know are good in these colors and I know to play them, and then I'm going to have some cool extra game plan fun. What you're really doing is, I'm going to cast these spells with Helva. How do I make that happen?
Right. And not every commander deck works that way. I mean, some do, and I think there's varying degrees. There's some decks that are barely based on their commander, or their commander only lets them play certain colors so they can do something totally not related to the commander.
Right.
You know, but most decks are still trying to do something specific, and it's up to you to determine how big of a game plan that is. If it's Helva, if it's Jaleva, I still have problems just saying Helva without explaining myself.
I think Helva might be the...
if it's Helva, the then it doesn't work. It's got to be Helva.
It's got to be Helva,
Helva has a hell of a big plan.
Yeah.
So you have to go all in on that plan. Otherwise, you can't halfway do that plan.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
But there are other generals where you can just sort of like have... You can sort of partway do that plan, and you can also just have a lot of good stuff. Yeah. You know, we talked about Animar a little while ago. You can't do that. You need a lot of creatures in Animar.
Right.
Yeah. You know, that's just the way you have to build the deck. You can't put a bunch of instants and sorceries there. Otherwise, you're not triggering Animar, and you're not doing the thing that the deck's, you know, that the general lets you do.
Yeah.
The other thing with Animar is it's so important to have a good curve in Animar.
Right.
Because you want to be able to just start going off on the turn you play him so that you can just start casting giant artifact creatures for free.
Right.
And when you start, if you don't take that into consideration, you're just going to be like, okay, Animar, turn four. Well, I only have six drops in my hand that are supposed to be cheaper, but I don't have small creatures.
Yeah, exactly.
Make and so I can't do anything, so I can't make them cheaper. Right. So I'm just going to play them on turn six. So why am I playing Animar?
Right.
Yeah. Which is another one of the points of what Josh had in how you determine correct ratios, which is how am I losing and why am I losing? Like, when I lose, what happens? In Animar, for instance, I only have six drops in my hand. It's like, well, maybe you should put out your cards, and this is actually effective, I think, in any deck to see what you need to cut. Lay out your cards by their converted mana cost. See where they lie. Like, in a normal draft deck of 40 cards, that curve is going to be a lot lower. You're going to want to have a lot of three drops.
Yeah, you want the hump in two and three.
Yeah,
and yeah, in EDH, I'd say four and five or five.
Four and five, yeah.
Five is the hump, right?
Yeah. Maybe four.
You can do 3 to 5.
Yeah,
depending on how
general,
you don't generally want to not do anything by the time five rolls around, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
So generally, you want to have played spells starting at least on turn three.
Right. Yeah. What I've noticed with EDH though is so like with draft or with standard or modern, there is a hump. Mm-hmm. Well, while in EDH, I've noticed there is no hump. It is much more of a you want to evenly have consistent cards to be played on every turn all the way up.
Right. It's okay to stack your deck with more expensive cards if you know that you'll be able to play them on time.
Right. Like, you can have as many six drops as you have two drops.
Right.
And that's fine, which you can't do that in regular Constructor.
Right.
But
well, it's fine
you
because
don't want to have all six drops and no two drops.
Yeah. Right.
Having an even level is really smart in EDH, which allows your deck to play cards consistently, but because you have so much more time, you can fumble a little bit more easily. Mm-hmm. You're not as like, I only want to draw one six drop all game. It's, if I draw three of them, then I'll just stumble and pretend, oh, I'm mana screwed, no one attack me, oh, wait.
Right.
Genesis hot wave for stupid mounts. Now I have all of the permanents.
Well, it's interesting because six drop is almost too much in a lot of constructed formats, which is really funny to think about because I'm so used to playing such bigger cards in Commander that, like, when I look at a card, I'm like, oh, this is great. And then I hear a discussion about it, and it's like, oh, yeah, we would never play that in Standard. It's never going to see modern constructed play. And you're like, oh. Right.
Six drop creatures only became playable in Standard when the Titans came out 3 years ago. Before that, playing a six drop creature in a not control shell was unheard of.
Right.
And even still, it's still pretty rare.
Right.
Yeah.
You need cards.
It's just a symptom of 40 life and the multiplier aspect. Right. So you're not going to get attacked legitimately, you know, sometimes till late in the game because of the multiplier aspect. Yeah. And you start with 40 life. So even if you are, the clock on you is twice as long as it would normally be. So, you know, it just allows you to sort of weather the storm a lot better than you could in Constructed. So, you know, mana curve is not the only way that you're going to lose games, though. You're going to lose games to all kinds of things, and that's going to help inform, you know, what maybe you need to take out of your deck and what you need to put in. You might be losing to, I don't know, Board Wraths.
Right.
You know, you got a creature-based deck like Animar, and you're losing to Board Wraths, you know, and every time somebody plays Wrath of God, you can't win that game. Well, that's a time to go. You look at your deck, and you say, okay, what cards help protect me from board wipes
and why are they counterspell?
Yeah. And you know, but if somebody's playing Supreme Verdict, you can't even counterspell it. So you start having to get a little bit, you know, you play Soul of New Phyrexia, which makes all your stuff indestructible, or you play the OG Avacyn, you know, who makes all your stuff indestructible, or you play Cauldron of Souls that makes all your guys have persist. Like, you just, and then you go in and you're replacing and you're trimming, you're cutting things from your deck so that your deck is protected against the thing that's beating it.
Well, there's many ways to kind of protect yourself from board wipes, including creatures that, when they die, good things happen to you. Creatures that are indestructible. Right. Creatures, you know, creatures that, the more creatures in people's graveyards, do stronger. I mean, it depends on what your game plan is. Something like Animar is really weak to those kind of effects.
Mm-hmm.
And so stuff like All Creatures Have Persist is really strong. Or just counter spells is kind of what you have to kind of do with them. Because eventually, you know, after turn five, if you're doing Animar correctly, you shouldn't be, you know, your creature should be free.
Right.
So you have all of the mana to start holding that mana.
That's why counterspells are so good, too, because they're not just an answer to board wipes. They're an answer to anything.
Right. Anything that could be answered.
Yeah. And they're also creature counterspells. There's the new card from Constant Secure that lets you morph, and you can counter by flipping it over.
Yeah, and there's like Willbender, and there's also
Mystic Snake.
Mystic Snake. Draining Well. So these are cards that in Animar are great because Draining Wolf becomes a two drop, basically comes counterspell that gives you giant creatures for free.
Yeah, exactly.
So mana drain, but without the mana, I don't know.
So I think the point here, though, is like, yeah, maybe board wipes is killing you. Maybe, you know, graveyard recursion is killing you. Like, that's yeah. We've talked about in meta discussion is like, you know, taking a look at your play group and what they're playing and right. what you're losing to. But a lot of times your own deck is why you're losing.
Right.
You know, and that's the part where you really need to pay attention because, you know, that's where your ratios are maybe a little bit right. off.
All right. these guys who are playing all these mana rocks that I don't own and all these artifacts are too good. What do I do? Well, maybe you should put Shatterstorm in your deck or another destroy all artifacts mm-hmm. spell.
Right.
That's when you start considering, my deck is weak to this thing. Now I need to cut a card or a card that is good against these things that I'm right. consistently losing to.
And I think that's where the parity thing comes in too, is because if you're in a losing state, you're going to want a card like Shatterstorm to get rid of the Brocks that are doing what your deck can't do, like ramp to that certain level, so that right. you need to... It's more important to instead of win more, which I think is another reason that we keep cards and we're emotionally attached to them, is because, but that one time I played this, I won so hard that everyone's never going to forget it.
Right.
It's like, but you're not going to want that card in a losing situation when it does you no good. So right. it's like you have to really keep that in mind too when you're cutting.
Yeah, so that's another category, is a win condition. You know, how does my deck win? And some it's built into, you know, the commander or the main mechanic you're doing, right. but some it's not. Some, you yeah. know, and it's some it's like, oh, I can do all this stuff with my commander that basically locks everybody down, but I need something that actually wins the game for me. So that's yeah. another thing you got to determine with your ratios. Okay, so let's say I've gone through this process, I've built my deck, I've tuned it a little, you know, I have my ratios, and now what?
Normally, I would say at that point, you have three cards that you just can't decide which one to get
yeah,
rid of.
Right. Yeah,
you're just right at that edge.
Like, oh, do I cut this cool one or this cool one? And it's there's actually a term that writers use, and we brought it up in Top Deck, but it's called kill your darlings.
Oh, right, right, yeah.
Is, you know, in those situations, for me, the thing I most often cut is like, okay, I have three cards I need to decide behind, between, and I'm like really close. The one I love the most is the one I normally will be the first one I chop off,
because it's probably the weakest,
right? Because it's right. like, well, I'm attached to it, so that means it's getting bonus points that it doesn't deserve, because yeah, I personally bonus like
points.
It.
Oh, that's really good advice, actually.
So yeah. I'm just like, that one's probably the
if
weakest.
If it's tied, but I love it, right. that means it's actually behind, but I'm giving it.
You're giving it that extra
yeah. extra bonus.
Yeah.
The other one,
hanging chads.
The only other like cute way of like, or like a trick maybe in this situation, is flip a coin.
Yeah.
And you don't actually flip the coin to...
You see which one you're rooting for.
Right, right. You flip the coin. You don't care what it actually lands on. It's when your heart decides in the flip card.
While the coin's in the air, yeah. you search your heart, and it's like, which one am I hoping wins?
Right, exactly.
And then I take that one.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And then I'd say playtest.
You know, yeah,
bring
that's
it
the
in,
last
bring
one.
It into a situation, and then start drawing until you hit those cards that may be the troublesome ones, and just see how they do.
Well, someone, and if you have close enough friends, you can be like, hey, guys... I'm trying this new card out. Just this really quick game. We don't have to play a huge EDH game. Right. I just want to start within my hand and see how powerful or terrible it is. Do you mind if we play this way? And a lot of times your friends will be like, yeah, but you know, you got to give me something.
Yeah, exactly.
What kind of friends you got? Jeez, that's...
Not dude, you guys.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I'd be excited.
I wouldn't
to
say that. I'd be
brew.
Like, sure, what the heck?
Right, right.
Jeez, I hope all of you out there have better friends than that.
Yeah, sorry, Kessler. I'm okay.
I'm Jimmy's like, you got to give me something.
You got to give me something now. You're on this podcast, you owe us something.
I'm friends with Jimmy, Craig, and Joe. That's my problem.
All right, so the last thing I wanted to talk about was just focus.
Yes.
You know, this is something that I see a lot, especially in like sort of newer players, which is like deck building. It's about making choices and committing to them. It's about tuning. Like I said earlier about the log line of your deck, the one thing that it's trying to do, it's about sort of going for that. You know, in general, this isn't always true, but 90% of the time it's true. If your deck is trying to do like four things, it's not going to do any of them very good.
Yeah.
And so it's just a lot better most of the time to just really try and do the one thing that you're trying to do.
Yeah.
And then there's this thing that I like to do in any sort of creative enterprise like this, which is like when I'm tuning it, is like drastically change it. So like instead of incrementally changing, like let's say I play my deck and it doesn't do that good. I don't like to like just change four cards in that instance. I like to change like 20 cards. And then I can sort of find that middle point. So
right.
I go from the right to the left and then I can find the middle. It's a lot faster than sort of slowly stepping from right to left one step at a time.
I think that's also something that you can kind of get a feel for the more you play
mm-hmm.
because... Mm-hmm. I mean, this is quoting from like designers from Wizards. They recommend not doing that in many instances when they're designing cards.
Mm-hmm.
When you do giant drastic changes, it makes it so you can't really find what's wrong.
Right.
If you like, if I take 15 cards out and I'm now playing a different deck and it now is doing well, well, which one of those 15 cards was a problem? Was it all 15 cards? Was it 4 or 15 of those 15 cards? You don't really know.
One of the things we talked about Marchesa in our very first episode, and we talked through that deck and we built that deck, and it's okay. It's not great. You know, after playing a couple times, I was like, screw that. And I just totally changed the deck just to try it.
Right.
Just to see if this is better. And I put in, you know, all threaten effects.
Yeah, you know, just take modular out or...
I put sack outlets and threaten effects, basically. And, you know, I kept card draw and ramp and those other things. And, you know, I tried that. Just, it's so drastically different. Mm-hmm. I could just immediately tell, you know, between those two choices that I had when we first sat down to make the deck, you know, I could immediately tell which one felt better.
Which direction feels better.
Yeah, exactly. That, and I guess that's what I mean is, like, you know, if I had just sort of dirtled around with...
If you're trying something and it doesn't work, especially if it's a linear strategy, then try something else. No reason to keep just forcing into a thing that just doesn't make sense, or at least the cards that exist right now don't really make it work right now.
And in your case, it was like, I like that too, because that is the essence of focus. And I think... the guys on LR talk about a lot, which is disciplined play and disciplined cuts, where you need to like look at yourself and be like, hey, look, if this isn't working and you're just emotionally attached to it, or you wanted to do it because it was a cool, fun effect, like modular in Marchesa, it's like then taking out that section of it to put in something that's potentially better, that's when you can like get rid of a bunch of cards all at once. And it's not going to be a huge cut out of your pocket too, because I don't think any of those cards are super valuable or whatever. But it's an easy way to say like, okay, this entire segment of this deck, this sort of like when the log line of Marchesa was, I'm going to put out these creatures and these type of creatures, when you can just get rid of a part of that sentence and replace it with something better, then that's an efficient way to essentially relook at what you're trying to do.
Right, but this is even a bigger change. I mean, you know, and I like what you're saying, but just to go back to that specific example, like, you know, this changes the entire deck, because all of a sudden it's all sorceries and instants, right? I want Quicken in there because I want to play my threaten like a Ray of Command. I also want Ray of Command in there. And I also want things like Archaeomancer and Mnemonic Wall to get back the stuff. Mm-hmm. And if I can reoccur them, and it's like, it creates this whole spiral effect that changes the entire deck, you know, and then so you do that, and you play that a couple times, and, you know, immediately I'm like, yeah, this feels a lot better.
Yeah, and that's when, throwing it back to what we were talking about, the log line, or sort of what is the one-sentence summary of your deck and its goals, that's where it can really be helpful. Because if you're examining your deck and you need to just essentially rewrite that sentence like you did with Marchesa, then, you know, if you feel the need to and you're not having fun or it's just not working the way you want to, I mean, there's no harm in at least trying it out. And, you know, if, obviously, if you don't want to purchase all the cards, you can go on Tapped Out and make the deck and draw sample hands out. And draw, you know.
Yeah, proxy too. Proxy, I mean, I think we've probably all proxied at a certain point.
But at the end of the day, you need to make sure that your cuts are based on what your deck is focusing on and figuring out what the correct ratios are. And the nice thing and the hard thing about Commander is there's no one set answer for anything. And really, I think the best way to just test anything out is just to playtest it, which is something that I'm sure you have done a lot with Gaddick Teague.
Yes. I mean, I built Gaddick Teague.
Bum, bum, bum. Segway.
We're all writing our segways now and podcasts at the same time.
Okay, so back to Gaddick Teague.
It's a segue back.
So our commander spotlight, we've talked about him a little bit, is Gaddick Teague. You want to read him, Alex?
Yeah.
Since he is your commander.
Gaddick Teague costs 1 green and 1 white. It is a 2/2 legendary creature. Kithkin Advisor is from Lore 1 block. And he has two abilities. He has non-creature spells with converted mana cost 4 or greater cannot be played, and non-creature spells with X in their mana cost cannot be played.
Wow.
Yes.
Yeah. So we said it was going to be a mean deck.
Yeah. It's mean in an interesting way. I always feel like it's being nice because it's making sure that people aren't playing mean things.
It's mean.
But like Genesis Wave, but apparently people take it as a, you aren't letting me play my spells.
It's mean. Yeah.
People take it very personally.
Yeah, they're very mad at me.
Which, understandably, I mean, so.
Yeah, Teague is one of those cards, and the cards that fall under this category are always considered mean, which is they change the basic rules of the game.
Right.
Right.
So I built my deck, and you guys built your deck, under the basic rules of Magic, but Alex's deck changes the basic rules, so my deck and Jimmy's deck now doesn't work.
Don't work. And in Commander specifically, this is the specific way people build their decks. Yes. Most people are playing giant spells, planeswalkers, board wipes.
The reason we play this format in a lot of ways, it's like there's all these cool, big, high casting cost stuff that you could never play in the other formats, but in EDH, it's not that just that I'm allowed to, but they're actually effective.
Right, and I have a small soft spot for Teague, because Teague was actually my first competitive EDH deck, where like I was really taking next level, and it came about because I was playing in an environment where there was only board wipes, only land, like it was mostly actually land destruction effects. I had friends who were just like every spell they played was land destruction or like, you know, not apocalypse.
Jocko Apocalypse.
Armageddon. Like these cards that would just destroy my lands. Armageddon. And so I was like, I'm going to play Gaddock Teague. I'm just going to make him super strong. The original deck was a very Voltron heavy, and that has greatly changed since then to much more of a prison style deck that kind of made it so that no one can do anything.
Right.
Except for yourself when you decide to, correct?
Right. I get to do all of the things.
Well, this these types of effects are always super powerful. You know, changing the basic rules of the game, and your deck is built for it and nobody else is always really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's... Gaddock is known as one of those hate bear decks. What hate bears are basically 2/2 creatures or around 2/2s. They can be 2/1s.
Yeah.
And that do stuff that hates on specific strategies.
They're normally, they're the safety valves that wizard prints to stop other people from doing dangerous things.
So they make spells cost more. They make your graveyard synergy not work. They make you not be able to draw cards. They do all kinds of like crap. Right. We're going to talk about some specific most ones, of but that's what hate bear is.
Right. Most of them say... this thing that people normally can do cannot happen.
Right. Fate Spinner, I think, is that classic blue one that we talked about on the Animar episode, where just like you have to skip a phase, do it. Sorry.
Right. And I would argue that
Fate Spinner
is not a card.
not a card.
Fate Spinner.
I think you would win that argument.
Yeah.
It's not a bear either.
I only win arguments.
You would argue that Fate Spinner is what?
It's not. It's technically a hate bear.
I think it's more of a weird effect because it's not stopping someone. People get to choose. It's more just a kind of like a cool control-y dirtly card, and I mean that with all of the love of dirtles.
Dirtle is wonderful. Yeah,
right.
I don't know if it's dirtly.
I think hate cards are generally more specifically stopping people from doing specific things. It's a little bit more specific or broad things. That one's like weirdly random and up to the decision of the person who's playing at the time.
So we're going to talk about some specific hate bears, but you know, really quickly, I think it's pretty obvious when you look at this card, like this deck wants to play no spells that are more than 3 mana cost besides creatures, right?
Right. In the deck, there is a total of 1 card that cannot be cast with Teague is in play.
So everything else can be cast with Teague's in play.
Yes.
Because that's your advantage. Right. I just changed the rules of the game, but that doesn't actually affect my deck at all.
Right.
I've been playing by these new
rules.
But
even if it only affects 20% of your deck, that's a pretty big advantage.
Yeah.
And most decks, EDH decks, is going to affect a lot more than that.
No, that's every hand. It's basically every player discards down to 3 cards.
Right.
So like, and normally those are the lands.
Right.
It's interesting, and they've slowly added a couple new cards recently that change this specific fact, but Teague... that 3 drop is a very important level because
Wrath of God is 4.
99% of all board wipes are
4
or above, especially the ones played in Modern. Because technically black and red have some 3 drop ones, but no one plays them because they're not destroy all creatures. They're give -2/-2 to all creatures.
Right.
So Teague himself dodges almost all ways that normally players kill creatures.
Right.
Because like, a cardinal rule of Commander and multiplayer play in general is that you shouldn't be playing Doomblades, you should be playing Damnations.
Right.
You should be playing cards that kill all creatures, not one creature, because 1/1 is so rarely going to be that strong.
Right.
And there are a few that are exceptions, like everyone in white normally plays Path to Exile and Swords of Plowshare. But those cards, we'll get to how to fight those cards with Teague, but those... are, you know, 2 cards in a person's deck, and they're not always going to draw them.
Right.
And you're not always going to be playing against white mages.
And you have answers to them.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so, yeah, go ahead.
Let's talk about some of the hate bears.
Yeah, let's do it.
First up is a card called Thalia, Garden of Thraben. It's a legendary creature for 1 and a white. First strike, but the more important part, non-creature spells cost 1 more to cast. So that's sort of the definition of what the hate bear is right there, right?
Right. So Thalia is actually probably one of the weaker hate bears in Teague in general because she's already kind of doing Teague is already doing. What's important about her is 2 things. 1, it makes it so the spells they do get to be able to cast are harder to cast. And 2, if Teague goes away, which there are...
it's going to happen sometimes.
Every opponent wants to happen.
Right.
She can maybe do a little bit of a like
stopgap
Teague mimicry while Teague comes back in play.
Now, we should say rules-wise, she doesn't up the cost of the spell. So she, no. Yeah, so she doesn't make it so that a, yeah, so that a three casting cost can't be cast because
right. She does not, just cost. She doesn't combo Teague in a crazy way that makes all three drops also not be able to be
cast. I just want to make sure we're clear about
that. She's one of those important cards that lets your deck function without the commander and still gets the job done, essentially, when your commander's not around, which is, as we've mentioned many times on the show, is a very important part to a lot.
So I've got another one here, another hate bear. It's Leonin Arbiter. It's a 1 and a white for a 2/2 cat cleric. It says, players can't search libraries. Any player may pay 2 colorless for that player to ignore this effect until end of turn.
So as we talked about earlier, tutoring is very strong in EDH.
Yeah.
Most players lean on it to make their decks consistent. Most players will be using that effect to find there may be one or two answers that might be able to get rid of Gaddock Teague. And so Leonin Arbiter and cards that have a similar effect, because I'm also playing Aven Mind Sensor, which does a very similar thing.
You can only do the top 4 cards.
Top 4 cards. That's the hate bird I was mentioning before. Make it so that it becomes much more difficult for my opponents to find the answers they need to kill Teague.
Right.
And protecting Teague is numero uno game plan number one, because as soon as he dies, especially if you get to the later game, your opponents have now had time to draw cards, play land. So the biggest spell they've drawn, they will cast immediately. So some of the crazier
like
situations...
floodgates have opened.
Well, a lot of times, too, they might just infinite combo off right then, because they've been sitting there waiting and just holding their best stuff.
It's one of the reasons I still like him, even though he's kind of a very strong and an unfair way general, is that when he dies, crazy game states happen, because the floodgates have been opened. These players will cast Genesis Waves for a ton, infinite combo, or like all go at each other.
Right.
And sometimes that's enough for you to just be ignored, because it's like, oh, we got rid of that one thing we got to worry about. Now let's go kill each other, because we have all our cool
spells.
Because
you were never an imminent threat. You just were seen as this weird stopgap that made everyone enjoy their game a little less.
Right. People's plan wasn't necessarily to kill you. It was to kill Teague. So I don't... And one of the ways to kill Teague is to kill me, and that is something we'll address. But the fact that once Teague is gone... Then they start to.
They don't
want
feel
to.
As threatened by.
They don't feel
threatened.
Like, oh, he's not doing anything. He's a bunch of 2/2s that do nothing. But that guy just casted crazy spells. I'm going to now use all these counter spells that I couldn't cast because they cost more than 4 mana to stop him from what he's going to be doing and go at each other.
So let's talk about how you protect Mr. Teague.
So there's a bunch of ways. Some of those are the ones people know about. Like Mother of Runes is really strong in Gaddock Teague. Lightning Greaves is very strong. Things that make it so he's untargetable. Some of the funds we're going to talk about, one of them is Dauntless Escort. Dauntless Escort is a 3/3 for 3. He's gold, so he's green and white. And you can sacrifice him to give all creatures you control indestructible until the end of the turn. The reason he is very powerful in Teague, and one of the reasons I like him, is there are a few board wipes that can stop you.
Toxic Deluge.
There's a few artifact ones that come that are 3 mana, and then you can tap them for 5 mana to do all the to destroy all creatures.
Right, because the artifact itself only costs 3.
Right, exactly.
And it doesn't matter how much the effect costs. Right. Teague doesn't stop that. Right.
So Dauntless Escort protects Teague, but it also lets you kind of protect your whole team just in case the worst case scenario happens and someone gets one of those like 3 ever printed in the history of Magic destroy all creature spells. And Toxic Deluge technically is not one of them,
because it's
not,
totally it's, new.
Right, right. Yeah, and it's and you have to pay X mana to do -X to all things, and so it's slightly different.
You mean pay X life.
X life, yeah.
Well, that card's great too, just because it does the job of like Soul of New Phyrexia. Not as you can't do it twice, obviously. Or
it protects all your guys too.
It protects all your guys, yeah. And for a 3 mana cost creature, like it does fit very well in the deck.
Right. And worst case scenario, if they get rid of Teague, he's also still there. Like sometimes I'll let Teague die because I'm like, well, the worst thing they're gonna do is wipe the board right now, and I'm gonna be great after that. But that other guy who's been casting giant creature spells, that mono green player, because his deck is also like Animar, Teague and Animar at the same time, Animar goes nuts because its biggest weakness is no longer available to the rest of the players. And I'll get to how to handle
that. Well, and also Teague only costs 2, so sometimes if they're gonna do that and it's gonna help you, and you're just like, well, no, he's just gonna cost 4.
Right. Yeah.
So,
exactly.
Big deal.
Right. The next card, and this actually is somewhat relevant to what we were just talking about, to protect Teague and also to be very political with Teague, is High Market. High Market is a land, and we were talking about lands that do stuff, so those are great. It taps for any mana or one colorless anytime you want, like a regular colorless land, but it can also tap to sacrifice a creature and gain a life for free. The reason this is important is twofold. The most common targeted removal spell in EDH are tuck effects.
Right.
So effects that put your general inside of your deck.
Chaos Warp, Hinder. Condemn.
Condemn. It's in the deck. Yeah. So I should know that. But
we've talked about tuck effects ad nauseum because they're great against almost every commander.
Right. Because like they're one of the few ways you actually can kill commanders in a format where it's very hard to do so.
Yeah. Right.
It's a more permanent death by throwing them in the deck than back into the command zone.
Right. Exactly. So High Market lets me protect Teague from those effects because the nice thing, one of the things that protects Teague more than anything else is that he costs 2 mana.
Yeah.
So worst case scenario, if he dies, I am, at least for the first few times, going to very easily cast him again.
Right.
And High Market lets me do it so in a way that, like, dangerous effects that I don't want to happen to Teague. So that, or, like, there's cards that Ixildor?
Exile?
No.
I was like, it can't be
it's
that.
Not, it's not a real...
He would know that word.
Exile instead of exile?
I think it's Ixildor. I might be getting this wrong. All you people on the internet will yell at me for not knowing what it is. But basically, he flips...
No, they'll yell at us.
Yeah. They'll comment furiously.
He turns every creature face down.
Oh, like, he morphs them?
He morphs them. So they lose all abilities that no longer exist. And then they're just kind of stuck in play, and you don't know what to do with them without attacking. And
right, and you can't get rid of them.
You can't get rid of them, so High Market fights against that. There are a bunch of random things that like High Market is kind of really good against.
Yeah, I thought it was really interesting that you listed it under protection, and it's great, actually. Yeah,
right.
Because there's just any of those. Or if they're going to do, you know, anything weird that you don't see coming, you're just like, whatever, I'm just going to put him back in the command zone.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So it High Market kind of gives you versatility there. It also is life gain, and which is nice. And the one...
That one life that is going to take you real
eventually
far.
Like, if you're tokening out, one life a turn can add up if you're Teaguing everyone and no one does anything for 10 turns.
For other stuff, yeah.
Right.
I like what you said, too, about being political, too. So right, I hadn't thought of that, but yeah, that's like, okay, I'll turn him off for a turn for you, and you let you do something, you know. There's an interesting card you've got listed here. Oh, there's one card I wanted to talk about really quick. It's Yavimaya Hollow. I don't think we've talked about this on the show, but it's important in a lot of decks, so it's a good time to talk about it. It's just another land that does stuff.
Right.
You know, all of our favorite. So you can tap it for a colorless, or you can tap a green and tap Yavimaya Hollow and regenerate target creature. So it's just another way to protect a creature, but it doubles as a land. So instead of just drawing a spell that let you regenerate your guy, you can tap it for colorless when you're not doing that.
Right. I would argue that in green especially, it is one of the best lands at protecting things.
There's very few commander decks that wouldn't be improved by just replacing one of your lands with that, one of your forests.
The biggest cost is if you're very color intensive and you don't have a lot of colors thing, which Teague has some problems with. I would say my biggest complaint about the deck that I've built is that I have maybe a little too many colorless lands and that their ability to produce actual
really
because
usually
be
in
stronger.
Two color decks you don't have that problem,
right? But you have to think on turn two you I want to be playing Gaddock Teague, and Gaddock Teague is two colored mana every single time, so
you need a green and a white in your opening hand.
Now mind you, turn two Teague isn't as important as you would maybe think, because no one's going to be playing three drop, four drop
They can
drop
still
spells.
Play their three drop stuff. So it's actually you just want to play them before somebody's turn four.
Right.
It might be your turn three if you didn't go first.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And worst case scenario, if it's their turn, if they get a four cost spell, the four cost spells aren't really the ones that you're super worried about. Mm-hmm. It's the 5, 6, 7 game winning spells that are so common in Commander that you really need to like.
So even if you get it on four, you're probably still good.
Right. Exactly. Gotcha.
So we see how the deck works, which is basically like gum everything up, like slow the game down, you know, for everybody, make it hard for them to cast all of their spells, you know. So the next question is like, how do you win?
Okay, so there are two strategies I've seen most common in Teague, and the one that I ended up actually choosing to be the strongest way of playing it is tokens, a token similar strategy. I'm already over committing with all these hate bears to the board with all of these small creatures that kind of need to get bigger, and on top of that, it's a kind of deck style I don't normally get to play because I am so wary of board wipes and all these things. And it's like, well, this is the one deck that the board doesn't get wiped. I might as well get to play with some tokens.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, cards like Gavity Township.
Gavity Township. It's a land, tap to add one to your mana pool. It's a multi-purpose land. And for two colorless, a green and a white, tap, put a +1/+1 counter on each creature you control. A pretty great land.
Yeah. I mean, he's played in Modern now, right?
Oh, it's a Modern staple.
So because you're doing tokens, it reminded me of this card specifically called Riss the Redeemed, which is, it only costs one mana, either green or a white. It's a 1/1 elf warrior, and it's for two and a green or a white, you can tap and put a 1/1 green and white elf warrior creature token into play. But more importantly, for four and then two green or two white, you can tap it, and for each creature token you control, you can put a token into play that's a copy of that creature. So you can essentially just double.
Right.
I mean, once you start doubling, then it gets nuts. It's just getting to the point where you're doubling that sort of is tough.
There's an argument to be made that the Return the Ravnica Guildmage is very, very similar to Rhys the Redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the V2Gazi Guildmage?
Yes.
So it's four, a green and a white. You don't have to tap her, but you put a 3/3 green centaur creature token onto the battlefield. And then for two, a green and a white, you can populate, which means you can put a copy of any token you've got onto the battlefield. So you pay six the first time, and then after that, you pay four just to keep making it. Yeah.
And the real reason I don't play Rhys of the Redeemed is because he is so much more about a dedicated token strategy.
Right.
Because he's so much about committing your mana to doubling the tokens you have, where Teeg is not that deck. It just has token-producing cards to go wide because it can. Right.
So this is a great example of focus then. You know, it's just someone might think like, oh, I want tokens. Rhys is great. He's in the colors. He's cheap. I can play him with Teeg and I can activate his abilities because they're not, you know, they're not non-creature spells or whatever. So I can make this deck work like that. But it kind of draws attention away from the more important parts of the deck and requires a strategy that's more all-in than what you're doing.
Right. Teeg allows a little bit more of a what is like good stuff kind of format building where, you know, because you have this weird deck construction effect that makes it so there are spells you shouldn't be playing, but beyond that, you just want to play the really good stuff that goes into that situation,
right?
Because he's kind of good by himself. Or Rhys the Redeemed needs a world to exist around him to make him as powerful as he possibly can be. Teeg and him don't get along. I mean, I would actually play Gaddic Teeg more in Rhys because Teeg will help you protect your Rhys the Redeemed game plan versus the opposite, because one can coexist in a deck doing whatever it wants, while the other one needs to be in an environment that makes it as strong as
built around
can be.
Him.
Right, and
although
that's
he would stop a lot of the stuff that you want to do, like your other token generators.
You
can't play Doubling Season. Right, you can't play Parallel Lives. You can't play.
Well, Teeg in that case is just like a good two mana. Play this card after you've created a solid board.
Yeah, it's like I put in 100 tokens into play and I play Teeg.
Right.
Go.
Well, I mean, you can.
I'm not saying it's not useful. I'm just saying it's.
When you're playing these kind of effects, it's like board wipes, to be totally honest. Teeg is kind of like a board wipe where, you know, it is a equal effect. And I'm doing bunny ears for the people that can't see it. Quotes.
The quotation mark bunny ears.
Yeah, quotation mark bunny
ears.
Right. Not the making fun of a person bunny ears. Where, yes, it's equal to everyone, but I control when it's going to happen.
Right.
I get to say when Teeg happens. Right. So I can play my big spells, and as soon as I'm like, well, I'm ready to protect all my tokens, then you play Teeg.
I'm on top of the hill. I want to stay on top of the hill.
Right.
Boom. Yeah. Uh-huh. And if I'm not on top of the hill, I just don't play.
That's in a Rhys Redeemed deck.
Yeah.
In a Gaddic Teeg deck situation, the token plan is more that because of what the deck's already trying to do, you want things that kind of make a bunch of small creatures on the board strong. And there are good token producing cards that kind of go with the plan in a way that's versatile and allows it to attack from different angles.
But I also like what you said about it's just sort of good stuff. Because once you have the shell, the prison shell, the hate bear shell, you're like shutting down everything. As long as you can sort of play anything that's sort of big and good, you know.
Right.
That's a creature, at least, you know, that gets around Teeg's text. And, you know, you can play like Elish Norn or, you know, because like, and normally Elish Norn's awesome. Don't get me wrong. But you can play anything like that as like your finisher because you're like, hey, I just put the stop sign on everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything I've got that can go is fine.
Well, Elish Norn, people play it like, people choose big, powerful spells to play in their decks.
Right.
And Elish Norn is normally one of the decks, you know, the choices decks pick. But with Teeg, they don't get to play their big, fun spells. And you still get to play yours because you've picked cards like Elish Norn.
Let's read Elish Norn.
So Elish Norn is a 4/7 that gives all opposing creatures -2/-2 and all of the creatures you control +2/+2.
She's a 4/7. I never even thought about that.
7/4/7. Oh, yeah. She's also vigilant.
Oh, she's vigilant. Okay. That's like a text that
not
I don't
key to.
Just
relevant.
To add, yeah, just to add a little
insult
more
to injury
on,
because they were like, they looked at that card and they're like, not very powerful. What if it had vigilance?
Those come from, normally effects like that normally come from the fact that it's a cycle, and so they want to give every single one.
Yeah, they wanted
one.
To. Right.
So
they wanted,
like, on Elishorn, it's not relevant, but on the green Praetor, having trample is really important, because the point is that he's a big trampling guy. So you want each of them to have, like, one of those little trinket effects.
Right. Sure, sure. Just defend the designers, man.
Here's the thing.
Elishorn did not need vigilance.
And you are never attacking with Elishorn. Anyway.
I win that argument. Thank you.
Because you never want that card, too.
All right, so let's talk about some cards you may not think of for the deck. So I see you've got one listed here. You want to read it?
Yeah, so one of them is Admonition Angel. What Admonition Angel does is she is a 6-drop angel for a 6/6 flying, but she has the ability of Landfall, which is whenever a land comes into play, she removes target creature from the game. So it's every single land is an O-ring.
When you play a land.
When you play a land. Yeah. But the problem is that when she leaves play, all those creatures come back.
Right.
So normally in Commander, she doesn't do very much because
They just kill her.
Because there's 1,000 ways to kill her, and she's the big target. But because Teague is protecting all of your creatures, and your entire game plan is to protect creatures, because even the fact that, yes, you're trying to protect Teague with Mother of Runes, she can tap to protect Admonition Angel if she
just
needs
as
to.
Well, yeah.
Right, they have a bunch of cards that are protecting
your creatures.
You can
Yavimai Hollow and Regenerator. Right, exactly. Yeah, they still work for both.
Right, you have a bunch of cards that are already protecting your creatures, so it allows you to play this card that is normally weak in Commander, but if it didn't have that one specific negative effect, it would be one of the most powerful cards, because the fact that every single land you play is a Path to Exile is crazy powerful.
But the fact that they come back from exile if she dies is the downside. But what Teague does is cover her downside.
Right. What Teague, the deck itself, how it's built to protect Teague, and Teague himself do together is protect her to make her just like an undefeatable win condition.
Now that's great, because that screams synergy in a deck that I'm assuming is hard to make cuts in, because in this case it's like, all right, well, one, I want to protect Teague, but at the same time I'm building in protection for other important creatures. So that means you can start looking at cards that have obvious downsides and potentially get, like, sort of negating or nullifying that downside. And Admonition Angel is a really good example of that.
Right.
You know, another cool thing, I think, you know, you mentioned Thalia earlier and how she can sort of do, like, a weak Teague impression. So let's say you've got Thalia in your hand and you play her out, but you've got Teague out. So you don't need them both. You can play the Admonition Angel and you can actually exile your own Thalia so that when they do board wipe, you get Thalia back. And you've got your backup Teague, like, ready to go. And so now you can, and you can actually sort of save some of your creatures. Like, let's say you're way ahead on board. You can start exiling a couple of your own guys so that inevitably if somebody, the only way you're going to lose is a board wipe. And so you're like, well, I'm going to still get 4 of my creatures back in play when that does happen.
Right.
So,
I mean, like, theoretically, if you're playing with fetch lands, which... Yep. This deck, you can. And
pretty soon we're all going to be playing with them.
Right.
Yeah.
Woo!
Thanks, Kant.
And if you're playing with that, you can at instant speed, say like they wipe the board, you can instant speed remove Teague.
Yep.
Put it under Admonition Angel. The board goes away and Teague comes back.
Yep.
So like there are cool, cute little things you can do with the Landfall ability that and Admonition Angel in general that are really fun.
Yeah.
Another card that, and this is the one card that you cannot cast with Teague that we mentioned earlier, is Green Sun Zenith. And
yeah, that is, when I saw that on the list, I was like,
is that there?
It says right on his card that you can't cast spells that have X in the casting cost. So yeah, I'm really interested to hear like the reasoning here. Go ahead.
This is the card I most often get like weird looks about in the deck. And every single time I've ever had it, it's been one of the more strong cards I could have been playing. And there's a few reasons for this. One, because if I have it turn one, I always use it to ramp. For those who do not know, Green Sun Zenith is a sorcery. It's 1 green and X. You can search your deck for any creature, green creature, that is has a confirmed mana cost under X and put it into play.
X or less.
And then you shuffle it back into your library. Mm-hmm. The nice thing, one of the cute things you can do with it is there are 0-cost green creatures that taps for mana. That's a land called
Dryad Arbor.
Mm-hmm. And so if I have it in my opening hand where the game plan is normally to cast Teague as soon as possible, I normally use it as a ramp spell turn one just because to get it on my hand, I'm not going to cast it for a while.
You get two lands out on the first turn.
The reason it's important is if it's in my hand and I'm not casting it, it means Teague's in play and my game plan is going great. So it's okay that this one card in my hand, while 4 cards in all my opponent's hands aren't doing anything.
Right. But it's your savior if Teague gets tough.
Right. So it's kind of what High Market does a little bit. And in the sense that if Teague goes away, then I get this extremely powerful card that can also save Teague in situations where he gets tucked into my deck.
Mm-hmm. So you're not ever unhappy to have it, because if he's in play, you're in good shape. And if he's not in play, well, you need to go get him.
Right, exactly. So he's kind of this, it's a weird safety valve and another thing that kind of lets me consistently make sure I have Teague available. And because it gets shuffled back in the deck, it's never not an existing card.
Right.
Like there are other cards that let you tutor, but more often than not, they, you know, you want to tutor as soon as you can.
Yeah.
So like if I have Teague and I have a tutor, I'm just going to immediately tutor for a creature. Green Sun Zenith kind of forces me to play a pattern that lets me, in the long run, make sure I always have Teague available.
Gotcha. Yeah, very interesting. The reasoning is great. It's just like, it's not what is, well, if it's under the category, not what you would think of. I thought of a card that is not what you would think of. It's Luminarch Ascension. It's an enchantment. It costs one and a white, so you can play it if Teague's out. It says, at the beginning of each opponent's end step, if you didn't lose life this turn, you may put a quest counter on Luminarch Ascension. And then for one and a white, you can put a 4/4 white angel creature token with flying onto the battlefield. Activate this ability only if Luminarch Ascension has four or more quest counters on it.
Right.
The reason I like this is because the deck is built to slow the game down.
Right. People aren't be able to play their spells.
I'm assuming like a lot of the time when Teague's out and your game plan's working, just not a lot's happening. People are draw going a lot or just playing small stuff because they can't play all their big stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So then you're much more likely to get the counters you need on this thing and just start pumping out.
Right. And it's an extremely powerful card. The biggest worry I have with it, and it's the worry I have with Teague itself, it's actually like...
Well, that was my other point, right, is that they already are going to hate on you because you have Teague.
Right.
So it's not... Yeah, the reason that the knock against this card in a lot of decks is like, well, every time I play it, people try and kill me.
Right.
But Gaddick Teague is my general. They're right. Already trying to kill me.
Right. So, so in one sense,
it's kill me more.
It's like they can't. They're already trying to kill me. So I might as well play a really powerful card that's the downside.
Right. And part of what the issue becomes is that Teague is all about managing your opponent's mental state into thinking, not kill the person with Teague, but just kill Teague. And all Luminarch Ascension does is make that battle just a little bit harder, because it's like, oh no, I just like, A, they get rid of Teague, I need to kill him. The easiest way right now for me to get rid of it is just to get rid of him. And B, I have to kill him because Luminarch Ascension says if I don't attack him every turn, he's going to win in four turns or less. So it's a great card. And if you're already playing a game plan that's mitigating what your opponents are doing to the point where you don't have to worry about that lightning rod effect, then go for it. And it's like anytime you can get away with playing Luminarch Ascension, it's a good idea.
Yeah, I just think very strong. I just feel like in this deck, the downside is mitigated because Teague is the type of general that like people
you're already drawing.
Smart people are going after you. You can politic all you want, but they know like he turns half their deck off.
Right.
So it doesn't matter if he's out.
Go all deep in.
Yeah,
that's completely valid.
I know that Teague is. I look through the deck list and I've realized that okay, board wipes are bad if they can get them off. Tuck spells are bad if they can get them off. But I've noticed actually you've got a lot of cards that are sort of offense on defense, essentially cards like Nova Blast Worm and stuff. So what cards in here specifically go against the cards that are trying to take out your board or take out other people? They sort of take out your key components.
So that leads us right into the discussion about cards that seem good but really aren't.
Right.
Because I notice you don't have any equipment in there, so I'm assuming you think that equipment's not that great.
I was originally playing with equipment, and that was like the original way I built the deck, was to make it very Voltron-y. And the thing I found was that you're already making... Teague is already this threat that people want to deal with. And by strapping all of these things to it, it's once again probably kind of my problem with Luminarch Ascension, is that you're drawing so much attention to yourself already by playing him that so much of the deck needs to be mitigating what they're doing and not trying to be offensive, on the offensive.
Mm-hmm.
So like what the sword plan really does is say I play Teague turn two and then I play Sword of Light and Shadow turn three. Everyone looks at me as like, not only are you stopping me from doing things,
you're about to start
just decimating people. Right. So we need to destroy you.
We're all definitely teaming up
right,
to kill you.
Exactly. And that's kind of why I moved away from the Voltron, just having Teague be this like stopgate that lets me play all these spells, to a much more hate bear controlly kind of situation. Because Teague is going to draw so much hate, I need a way to stop people from attacking me. And the sword aggressive Voltron-y decks are so much about attacking people and being the aggressor. And Teague does help to a certain extent, but the problem with Teague, and the problem you'll always find with Teague, is that when you're playing with multiplayer, every single player is now focused on you.
So what
you need to do is mitigate their focus on you by either making it so they can't attack you, they can't play their spells, they can't do anything to harm you. The spells that they still can play, not necessarily become an aggressor, because maybe you'll kill one person. Maybe I killed Josh, but Jimmy just had all of the time I spent equipping Teague and going after Josh to draw into the cards that let him try and defeat me.
Okay, so we've talked about what the deck's trying to do, you know, how it's going to work, how it's going to win. You know, what disrupts the deck? What, like, when people play it, are you just like, ah, oh, crap? Like, we've talked about board wipes quite a bit, board wipes that cost three or less. We've talked about tuck and how you deal with that. What other things, you know, combat the deck?
Creature strategies. We've mentioned it before, but one of the biggest problems the deck ran into and kind of what it ends up causing to happen is your deck is so mitigated on stopping people from playing spells that the decks that don't have any spells on them just can go wild. Yeah, the reason board wipes are good in EDH is because they stop people that are just going to be playing, like the mono green ramp decks, they're just playing giant creatures. Mm-hmm. And when they're let to go off without any worry, like I don't have to hold
my spells, because
I'm protecting them also,
yeah, exactly.
They start going crazy. Like the Animar deck before we were mentioning, you know, that deck, its biggest weakness and its biggest stopgate from probably being too powerful is the fact that board wipes exist. And if I'm on the battlefield, that guy's like, thanks, buddy. I'm going to go off and win. And you're not, like, no one's going to be able to stop
so
you.
So creature-based strategies
it.
are very strong against it. I would think, like, targeted removal is probably, you know, there's not a ton of it you mentioned, but people play Path to Exile, Swords. You see the odd, like, Mortify or, you know, that kind of stuff. Especially instant speed, because you've got to cast him and then protect him somehow.
Right.
You know, and if you want to cast them on two or three, you know, they could just Doomblade.
And that's kind of why the deck is so focused on protecting Teeg in as many ways as possible. Mm-hmm. Because from the beginning of the game, when everyone flips their commander over and sees it, before mulliganing happens...
Yeah, you get meta.
People have already been...
People already know, I need to save my Path to the Exiles and my target of removal for one creature, and that creature is Gaddock Teeg. Those can be a definite problem because that's people start planning to have them. So it's all about mitigating how to defend yourself against those.
Gotcha. And that's half protecting your creature through cards and half through politicking.
Right,
like,
exactly.
I can do this with Teeg for you if you'd like.
Which is why I like High Market so much. High Market, which we kind of talked about, but one of the things
really
High
like
Market
that.
Does to protect Teeg is the ability to
him.
Say, I can get rid of it when you need me to at the worst case situations. Let him live for now.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's actually, you know, I like how you process the game on that level at all times also. You know, we think that's just as important as the cards. And I think people don't think about that enough, is having a few cards in their deck that allow them to politic.
Right.
You know, that's a good way to take a general that's really scary and normally people would just 100% gun for you and make them only 80% gun
right.
for you. You know, that's... It's a big difference.
And that mindset is legitimately the biggest barrier from competitive players to playing Commander or multiplayer games. So many of my friends who are modern players or standard players or drafters that don't like modern or don't like Commander, it's because they don't like the fact that they don't have a control or the tools they know how to play. The tools that they have that they normally have to play Magic don't normally focus on mitigating people's emotions beyond just the cards.
It's manipulation of your opponent's emotions, except for on a super basic level,
don't
exist in 1-1.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's much more maybe about intimidation versus like, you know,
that's the one I'd say, like fear, like getting somebody to fear you. That is the only form of manipulation.
Or tilting them. There are many ways that like there is emotions in Magic. That's what I'm saying.
In 1-on-1. Yeah, but
that like... There are multiple players that you have to worry about at all times, and sometimes even if you play every spell correctly, you'll still lose because other people will just team up or whatever bad things happen
like
to you.
It's like one of my favorite sayings, it's not what you're doing, it's how you're doing
exactly.
it.
Exactly. And they just don't know that they need to change their strategy and use the newer tools that are available to them to still play correctly.
Right.
That what they consider playing correctly is no longer correct.
Right,
because in the 1v1 situation, you don't need to worry if your opponent is going to attack you. They're going to do their best to win the game as well.
Right, and there's not as much of the board stalls. There's not people not doing anything, waiting for something to happen and hoping no one attacks them. There's all these little small things that you just need to remember to focus on, and it's just something that a normal 1v1 player doesn't focus on.
Right.
And High Market, cards like High Market, cards like...
Yavimaya Hollow.
High Market cards like High Market cards like False Prophet, these cards that kind of, and False Prophet is a card that when it leaves the battlefield, it's a creature. When it leaves the battlefield, it destroys all permanents. Removes all permanents?
Exiles
all permanents. These are cards that kind of mitigate people's emotions to either not want to attack you, not want to cause bad things to happen.
Because you can punish them in ways, and you can also reward them by essentially you're putting, because you're so controlly, in two colors, by the way, that aren't control, which is, I think, hilarious about Teak,
right,
that you have the ability to use your own control to just simply further control.
Well, and all of the control is in play.
Right.
So everyone sees what's going on. It's not like a blue player where they have to be worried about what's going to happen. Mm-hmm. And in most case scenarios, that blue player has a small advantage because the mystery of the unknown can sometimes be surprising.
Right.
But the difference is that because everything I have on the table is, I'm dealing honestly with people in a way to manipulate them.
Yeah. Well, we talked about this in our politics episode. That's two of the strategies. One right. is like, you know, bluffing. Like,
right.
you don't know what I got in my hand. I can just be like, you don't want to do that, and just hold up a card
right.
that you can't see.
Just,
and then,
like
yeah.
A
but the
island.
Other way is to, like, actually show strength.
Yeah.
So there's
right.
projecting strength, and there's showing strength.
Right. And
this is showing strength, and it's saying, like, hey, look at what I've got on the table. You might not want to.
And it's like strength that you can see, but is, like, not currently going on.
Right.
So stuff
right.
like false profit, where.
This doesn't have to happen.
Right. You know yeah. I have this. I have it right now. I'm not going to use it. But if you come at me in any way, I'm going to sacrifice false profit with high market, and everyone, your
right.
all your stuff goes
yeah.
away. So
right.
just
it's,
don't focus.
So you
on
might
me.
As well kill that other guy.
Right.
It's like having Nevermore's Discount, which is a card that everyone has access to. It's like once you're able to untap with it, then it becomes your biggest.
It's the button.
Button. Red
right.
button.
It's no like, one. No one attacks you because like as soon as I attack you, you're just going to wipe the board. So
yeah.
I might as well attack other people.
Okay, so we see that people are gonna fight your deck by doing board wipes, you know, low casting cost board wipes, tucking Gaddick, using 187 creatures or just big creatures or just creature-based strategies in general. You know, they're gonna do some targeted removal maybe. So you know that's all the ways that they're gonna try and counter your deck. What are, you know, your counters to their counters?
So we've discussed some of them. We discussed how to protect against targeted removal. We discussed mm-hmm. ways to deal with, you know, people hating on you specifically, just like every way they can come at you, they will.
Mm-hmm.
So the big thing I noticed, and this is what happened when I first built the deck, and this is kind of coming from that tuning and cutting process we talked about before, is I built this Voltron-style deck that was being aggressive and drawing all this hate and not being controlly, and all it ended up doing was letting these big creature decks win, because
mm-hmm.
I would stop mm-hmm. the people, the control players, from doing anything, letting these giant creature decks just roll through because nothing's going to stop them.
Mm-hmm.
And so the thing I decided was, okay, or the thing I realized is that I need to have board wipes. So it's really important to have creatures
right.
that can wipe the board. Because,
yes.
And there are a few that are printed. An
well,
example
how
is,
do you counter creature strategies? You
board
play
wipes.
Board wipes, but
right,
your
right.
deck doesn't allow board wipes. So your answer was put in creature board
right.
wipes,
creature-based board
which
wipes.
Most people don't play. So now you're the only person with board wipes in the game. It's brilliant. Like
right.
when I saw the list, I was like, holy crap, that is
yeah,
really
I
smart.
I play
yeah.
like six of them. And the
yeah.
reason you play so many is like they're important. It's the same reason in normal decks you play a bunch of board wipes.
Yeah.
These function as a button of do not mess with me or I will wipe the board. And you can see I can do that, but they're also there to stop people like Animar going off.
Right.
Where, like, there
right.
are strategies in EDH where it's all about playing as many creatures as possible, and Gaddick Teak doesn't stop them. And most of the hate bears have trouble stopping them to a certain extent. And you don't want them to go off because the point of magic is to win. So you need answers to those situations.
Right.
So stuff like False Prophet, stuff like Nova Blast Worm, these are cards that destroy all creatures in ways that you can cast.
Mm-hmm.
And it becomes mm-hmm. and it was exceptionally important. So I moved much more into a control-y, green-white, weird hate bears deck instead of the aggressive aggro deck that Gaddick Teak was originally built to be.
Right.
The great thing, though, about creature-based board wipes are their creatures. So
yeah.
if you don't need them as a board wipe, you can use them to attack and hit people in the face. Like
right.
Nova Blast Worm's great. Like, he's a 7-7.
As soon
he
as
not?
He taps, though, he blows everything
oh,
up.
Oh, it says all other creatures.
Right, he gets the attack.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Right, right.
Yeah.
But you'd still destroy your board. But
yeah. Yeah, I'm just
well,
saying.
The
like,
interesting about them is that it's also, like, because they're creature-based effects, they're hard to counter.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got Yavimai Hollow
right.
out, you can still attack with
right.
them and save Teak, and
exactly.
then you just keep going, and it's like, hey, I have a 7-7, you guys got nothing.
Right.
You know, that's you know, a good thing. Like, they still work as win conditions, too. Well, not all of them, some of them.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, it ends up that most of the board wipe on creatures are big creatures.
Because
mm-hmm.
they don't want you to play them on turn three.
Right,
yeah,
exactly.
Or for
it's
only
like,
three mana, yeah.
Because wizards, they're very powerful effects,
right.
and they have to be costed correctly. And normally when they're expensive, especially in the colors of white and green, wizards want them to be big. Because, oh, if you're going to play seven mana, it's not just for the board wipe, it's for the 4/5 flying angel
right.
or the 7/7 super worm. Like, these are cards that are really cool, so they're big. And that's just how kind of wizards creates cards and costs them to make them exciting. But it also is convenient because I get these win conditions attached to board wipes that...
Yeah, exactly. They were really smart. I didn't see those in a lot of lists when I was looking online. So that's something that I thought was really good. Another thing I noticed is and this makes total sense, is you have a lot of creatures that they have recurrence.
Oh, yeah.
Or you want them to die or you don't care
if they die.
Oh,
right, right, right.
Like Wurmcoil.
Yeah, a lot of the
especially
cards
especially a 6/6 that turns into 2/3/3s if it dies.
Yeah,
right,
and,
right.
And has Death Touch and Life Link.
Death Touch and Life Link.
Yeah, it creates two tokens, so it has value. I mentioned earlier Yavimaya Elder, where these are cards that when they die, there's an effect that's given to me, and it basically mitigates the fact that people are going to try wiping the board any way they possibly can, even though they can't through Teeg. But once they kill Teeg, they're going to. So it's kind of to stop people from doing... Stop encouraging people from doing so, or make it so that because I'm putting everything on the board and because I'm committing so hard to that strategy, I need to mitigate the weaknesses to that effect, which is I have a bunch of creatures in play. I need to make sure I don't, if the worst case scenario happens, I'm not just stuck in the mud and screwed because
if they toxic deluge, you don't just lose.
Right. I have a lifelink or a death touch that's going to protect me from things.
Yeah,
or
you have some stuff. Yeah.
I got to draw a couple cards or all creatures are destroyed because of false prophets.
Okay, so we've gone through the deck. Do you want to give us like a quick walkthrough of how it plays? Like, how does it usually play out?
So early turns is all about getting Teeg into play and protecting him. This is a good stuff deck, so when you go through the deck list online, you can see that there are cards that are just naturally good that aren't necessarily part of the plan, and if I have them, I'll play them if it's early and aggressive and it works. But really, it's about getting something like Mother of Runes, Lightning Greaves, or Saffy's Eric's Daughter, which can sack to protect Teeg.
Just any gun to protect.
Or curve Teeg into Dauntless Escort. All these cards that kind of protect it, so that I can get Teeg out and stop my opponents. Once that happens, it's all about getting as many of the hate bears into play. Once that happens, it becomes much more about mitigating it, making sure that the fact that Teeg is out and the fact that now every single person on the table is here to kill me or is now motivated to stop me doesn't stop me.
Right, doesn't matter. They can't.
So like playing prison cards, playing cards that make it so it costs money to attack or cost mana to attack me.
You charge money?
Yeah, $6. There's a toll. It's a toll road.
A magic card right there.
It's unglued, but I just kind of go with it.
was sarcasm for the sarcastically impaired.
Playing cards that discourage attacking me, as we've talked about. Kind of going with all the cards we've talked about in the game plan, and then it becomes the time to start becoming an aggressor. Once people become locked out or start, stop being able to do the things and just make it so the game doesn't last forever, start killing them with tokens, swing with these big creatures that I'm now being able to play, swing with people like Elesh Norn, where it's just like giant creatures that stop them from doing anything and are giant and let all my creatures to be much bigger.
Which is actually, Elesh is kind of a board wipe built into a creature as well.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I play Elesh Norn more for the board wipe effect than the pump effect, though the pump effect is nice because I already said that I'm already doing a small token strategy, which is convenient with Elesh Norn.
So it's lock down the board, play good stuff, win.
Yes.
Yeah. Sounds pretty good. You're essentially going in, constructing...
Sounds mean. I like it.
Yeah, yep. You're constructing the biggest, baddest dam you can make. And then when it's time, you open your own floodgates and destroy everyone else.
Right. I'm the only stream let through. I'm the Colorado River making a Grand Canyon.
You made it all the way
through. The thing I like about this
geologically impaired, that's
the thing I like about this deck is you sit down and you turn off half at least of everybody's deck.
Right. Right.
I mean, you just literally say, "Oh, half your cards aren't going
to
work."
I don't like to play it all the time because people get mad at you eventually. Yeah. So if you build a Teeg deck, make sure to have other decks to play, or your friends will stop liking you. For instance, actually, I don't think either of you have ever seen me play Teeg.
I haven't played against the Teeg deck out of the left side of nowhere.
It will happen, and hopefully we will know what to do.
I'm going to have to pull out my Joyra deck, and we'll see.
Yeah.
I can get around it with Joyra, right?
No.
Why not?
Because the suspend, you still cast a spell that costs 12 mana that's not a creature.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Play Joyra, please.
I'm going to play Annamar and then just build in tons of counter spells.
Okay. How many counter spells do you know that are under 4 mana?
Rap.
This is the problem. So
it's
what you really should do is
really
play...
want to play is Rune or or like, Annamar or
Rachesa?
No.
Rafik. Yeah, Rafik.
Yeah, or play Rafik where like
except all your sweet enchantments aren't going to make it on the battlefield.
Yeah, yes and no. I mean, you're still swinging with a 8/8 general damage, right, and any sword you attach to him. There are many things in the Lafique decks that cost cheaper that pump for a lot.
Yeah, that's true.
So
lots of unblockable effects.
Right, and I think you guys mentioned that you want to play with some Exalted in Rafique, so the Exalted itself is going to make it better. So those kind of effects make it very strong.
Right.
But yeah, big attacky creature decks are good against Teeg, because then they kill Teeg, and then everyone else can play their spells. Yay!
Yeah, it's definitely tough. You've built this deck, and it's you know, talking about cutting cards and tying it into the main topic, it's got a lot of aspects to it where it says, like, you've taken the cream of the crop, you found the cards that have the most value, that give you the best possible result when you play them, and the ones that can work in so many different situations that Teeg is just... He's a very lockdown deck that has a very all-around, just, like, strong shield around him.
Right, exactly.
Shields that attack, shields that protect, shields that sack. Like, all of these different things do what you want to do.
These have always been my favorite kind of decks. I don't play them in EDH because people get mad, but, yeah, prison decks in general. Right. Like, you know, I used to run, like, an old Stasis deck that, you know,
right,
and, got, like, an instill energy out on a Birds of Paradise and just, like,
right,
you know, sorry, nobody gets any turns. You know, Winter Orb was one of my favorite cards. Ankh of Mishra. Just stuff that just says, like, hey, the normal rules of the game, forget them. Throw them out the window.
I just love this. It's a control deck in red and white. Like, you don't green. Really... green and white. Jimmy the Red came out there. I wanted it to be red. It will never be a
There are
red-white
red. Control decks. That happens. Don't worry about it. Yeah, you just... lots of board wipes.
Ah, I see.
All of the board wipes.
Okay, so... Kessler, where can we find you on the worldwide interwebs?
Okay, so there are a few cool places to find me. First is on Twitter. I am at Kess Wiley, KessWylie. You can also find us at the sister podcast to the Command Cast called The Masters of Modern, which is second episode should be coming out any day now. and I'm also, you know, the creator of Top Decking. So we're on WebSizeNetwork.com and YouTube. It's a web series about Magic the Gathering, all the thing that you guys love.
The best web series about Magic the Gathering.
It's like the best.
It is. It's awesome. You guys got to check it out.
And of course, if you guys ever want to check us out, all our information is always stated at the end of the podcast, which is nice. But yeah, please let us know what you guys thought about Gaddick Teeg. Let us know if you guys agree or disagree with anything, or if you actually have any notes about cutting cards too. We'd love to just hear any kind of input you guys have, because we love hearing it. Just tweet it at us at CommandCast, and we'll always have a reply waiting for you.
Yeah, we also like to encourage you in the comments section, if you have any other philosophies you use for cutting or trimming your deck, we'd love to hear it. It'll be helpful to people who find this podcast later, and they can just look down and they can hear all kinds of different viewpoints.
Yeah,
so
we definitely didn't cover everything. It's a very broad and big topic. So
All right.
I challenge you to make a better deck for Gaddick Teeg than me.
Ooh.
Oh, the gauntlet has been thrown.
Gauntlet laid down.
The gauntlet has
and
been
knowing
thrown.
You, Alex, you will look at every single one of the decks that gets submitted. Oh, yeah.
Please send them to me. I want to look at them.
Yeah. Comments. Steal all comments, people. Ideas. Comments.
Exactly.
He will be trolling them for the next week or so, I'm sure. All right, Alex, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, next time we'll talk about maybe another one of your decks. Who knows? But
Guys
thank
of
you for
Saint
coming.
Draft. I already announced
Guys
it.
Of Saint Draft. Yeah, well, Guys of Saint Drafting.
Uh-huh.
Let's all go draft. I don't know.
Okay.
Dumb joke. Midnight. It's tired. We're all late. Wait. So... No. It's late. We're all tired.
It's tired. We're all late. And on that note,
word.
Peace out.
See you next week.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com or ask us on Twitter at JF Wong and at Josh Lee Kwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.
Angie has made it easier than ever to connect with skilled professionals to get all your jobs projects done well.
I absolutely love this because, you know, if you own a home, it can be really hard to maintain. It's hard to find people that can help you for a big project or a small. Well, whether it's in everyday maintenance and repairs or making dream projects a reality, it can be hard just to know where to start. But now all you need to do is Angie that and find a skilled local pro who will deliver the quality and expertise you need. Angie has over 20 years of home service experience, and they've combined it with new tools to simplify the whole process. Bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie can handle the rest from start to finish. Or help you compare quotes from multiple pros and connect instantly, which means you can take care of just about any home project in just a few taps. Because when it comes to getting the most out of your home, you can do this when you Angie that. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.